Let's call the case.
Case number SCWC-27580, Hamilton v. Latham, arguing for the petitioner Rebecca Copeland, also appearing for the petitioner Robert Thomas, arguing for the respondent Stephen Kiyoki, argument on the merits.
Ms. Copeland?
May it please the court. This case is about the real world of parenting. Regrettably, neither the public nor the courts below have received the guidance to know where the line is drawn protecting parental discipline in the civil temporary restraining order context. Guidance that is necessary so that parents know how to exercise their right to discipline without fear of running afoul of the law. We know the line in criminal cases, as this court articulated in State versus Molitave. Parents have a fundamental constitutional right to discipline, a right that includes the reasonable use of corporal punishment. For that reason, the line needs to also be clear in civil cases. We are here to ask the court to do two things today. First, reverse the lower court's decisions because Mr. Latham's acts were protected parental discipline. And second, provide guidance to the family courts as to where to draw the line protecting that right, akin to the findings made in a criminal context. The right to discipline doesn't mean that parents have the right to abuse their kids, but what it does mean is that in this type of case, courts must give clear reasons why actions that would otherwise be protected discipline instead warrant a finding of abuse and the issuance of a temporary restraining order. The courts below erred in two respects. First, failing to articulate and apply a discernible standard to protect the constitutional right to discipline. And second, failing to recognize and give effect to Mr. Latham's statutory residual parental right to discipline. Turning to the first point, parents have a constitutional right to discipline, and this court has recognized that that right includes the right to use reasonable corporal punishment. Due process requires that that laws give people of ordinary intelligence fair notice of what is prohibited. The problem with the lower court decisions in this case is that that notice wasn't given. Rather than giving some reasons why the acts committed by Mr. Latham, which could be and are within the realm of parental discipline, warranted a finding of abuse and a TRO. Instead, there's essentially a gap between the findings that were made and the ultimate conclusion and issuance of the order. If this court looks to the findings made at the evidentiary hearing, there were protracted arguments, a demand to continue an unresolved discussion, a loud argument that ensued, that Mr. Latham struck his daughter, and that he threatened further physical harm. But none of those findings, either on their own or together, are abuse in and of themselves. Instead, those are all well within the realm of parental discipline. This court has noted in a number of criminal cases in interpreting...
Court only cited one instance of abuse, and that was... Was it the 25th of August?
That's correct. The incident that involved Mr. Latham's daughter apparently helping a friend obtain the morning after pill were when these instances, these acts occurred.
So as to the other incidents testified to at the hearing, what do we make of those incidents?
Well, though, as the ICA concluded that those instances also informed the court's issuance of the TRO, however, even those acts are parental discipline because we may not agree that parents have a right to strike their child or to corporal punishment, but they do. However, the specific findings in this case that led to the conclusion did not include the other instances that happened at different times. And those findings weren't sufficient to lead to the conclusory abuse conclusion in the issuance of the TRO. In State versus Molitave, this court held that striking a 14-year-old on the hands...
From the facts, excuse me, that the other instances weren't mentioned the inference that the court didn't consider those as coming within the abuse statute?
Well, those instances aren't noted in the finding of fact number three. Finding of fact number three. However, though any instances that were testified at the hearing that involved acts of striking or threats of physical harm are within the realm of parental discipline. Striking a child with a plastic backpack, a plastic hanger, a car brush, and the plastic handle of a tool, leaving bruises and marks all over the 14-year-old's daughter's arms and legs, was found to be protected parental discipline by this court in State versus Molotave. In this case, the daughter testified that there was no bruising, so there was no actual physical harm. And in fact, under the definition of domestic abuse in Hawaii Revised Statute 586, there has to be a finding of physical harm, bodily injury, assault, threat of imminent physical harm, bodily injury or assault, extreme psychological abuse, or malicious property damage. The family court in this case made no such findings, and that is why the ultimate conclusion that Mr. Latham engaged in abuse and therefore a TRO was warranted is conclusory, and there's a gap there. And what we're asking this court to do, in addition to reversing that decision because of the gap, is provide guidance so that family courts know how to protect the parental right to discipline. There's no guidance currently letting the court know that you can look at, for example, the age and size, the due regard to the age and size of the child, that the acts were committed to promote the welfare. These are the essence of parental discipline, and the courts, I need guidance to know to apply that in this type of situation to protect the fundamental constitutional right.
If I might interrupt you, Ms. Copeland, I'd be interested in your view as to what role, if any, did the TRO play in the underlying dispute over custody?
There's no express evidence in the record as to what role it played. However, I think the circumstances suggest that it did play some role in the child custody proceedings that were going on simultaneously. And as a result, Mr. Latham was not able to modify the child custody arrangement. And this is one of the continuing collateral consequences, for example, that this court recognized the first time this case came before it. Other collateral consequences because of the harm on the public record include undermining the reputation and standing in the community and adverse effect on a professional or personal life. And that underscores the importance that family courts are given some guidance to protect the fundamental right in these types of cases. Without such guidance, the lower courts in this case essentially applied.
I can't recall specifically, but did you mention in your papers that reports had to be sent to two state agencies as a result of the TRO issue?
In the certiorari petition, we did not, no.
What about below?
I don't recall from the briefing. I know that there were some amendments to the statute after this case started, and I'm not sure if those reports were made in this case. Rather than applying an ad hoc sense of what the standard is, essentially an I know it when I see it standard of abuse, the court should instead look to similar factors like those in the criminal statute in order to provide clear findings that would take otherwise protected discipline outside the realm of the constitutional protected disciplinary right and into abuse. Otherwise, you would end up, for example, with a situation where a parent would spank a child and could end up in this exact same situation. And as I said before, although we may not agree with that type of corporal punishment, parents have a right to do it, and the statute and the way the statute is applied by the family courts must protect that right. In addition to the constitutional ground, the additional reason why this court should reverse the lower court's decision is because the family courts and the ICA disregarded Mr. Latham's statutory residual parental right to discipline. Under Section 571.2, a residual parental right is defined as those rights that remain with the parent after the transfer of legal custody. In State versus Stoker, this court recognized that under that statute, during periods of authorized, unsupervised visitation, a non-custodial parent retains the right to discipline a child, even if the parent no longer has legal custody. That is the exact situation that occurred here. Mr. Latham was exercising his unsupervised court visitation at the time these acts occurred. In its December 7, 2011 order granting in part Mr. Latham's request for judicial notice, this court took judicial notice of two important documents. First, a stipulated order on post-decree relief dated September 22, 1999, and second, an order on post-decree relief dated August 27, 2003. The 1999 order established Mr. Latham's visitation rights, including unsupervised court visitation. The 2003 order, although it gave Mr. Latham's ex-wife legal custody, specifically stated, quote, the current visitation schedules shall be followed. Because Mr. Latham had unsupervised court visitation when these acts occurred, he retained that residual parental right to discipline his daughter during those visits. For that reason, the court's finding that because this was a, quote, moral issue and that legal custody was with the mother, and therefore Mr. Latham didn't have a right to discipline his daughter, is incorrect under the statute and State versus Stoker.
What is your position as to the specific conduct of the daughter during the visitation that she was being disciplined for?
Actually, Mr. Latham testified that he was administering parental discipline, and his daughter also admitted that what she had done was wrong. And there's a similar case to that out of the ICA called State versus...
Specifically, Stoker indicates that the residual parental right is for conduct that occurs during the visitation. And in Stoker, the child did not come to the parent as directed. In this case, what was the act of the daughter during the visitation for which she was being disciplined?
There wasn't a specific act at that particular moment. However, that residual parental right to discipline is nevertheless protected under the statutory scheme and under the fundamental right to discipline.
So there was no act during the August 22nd, 2005 visit for which she was, no conduct during that visit for which she was being disciplined?
Mr. Latham had requested to speak with her about the incident, and so there was some disagreement among them about whether or not he would be able to speak with her. She was on the phone at the time with a friend, and it was late at night. But as far as the actual act of helping the friend obtain the morning after pill, that occurred at an earlier time. But Mr. Latham still had that right to discipline her.
For having assisted her friend?
Excuse me?
For having assisted her friend?
For what the family court described as, I suppose, the moral issue. The fundamental right to discipline under the Constitution actually arises from a parent's fundamental right to care, custody, and control of a child. And it's that overall responsibility that parents had to raise their kids from which that right to discipline comes. And so although the acts didn't occur at the specific time when she was on the phone, Mr. Latham, under his fundamental right, which includes the right to care, custody, and control, retained the ability to discipline her on those issues, even if it was a moral issue.
But the court in Stoker held that it was conduct that occurred during the visitation that the residual parental right to discipline applied to, correct?
That's correct, and I understand the court's concerns, but I think even because the right to discipline is both statutory and constitutional and is a overarching fundamental right to discipline, Mr. Latham continued to retain that right at that moment on that particular date when he chose to discuss that with his daughter.
Maybe Judge Crandall is trying to get at, and I guess she can clarify, but you know, what is the exact nature of the act for which the daughter was being disciplined. You know, was it about helping her friend obtain a birth control pill, which the court says is a moral issue that should be resolved by whoever has legal custody? Or was it her refusal to talk to her father about it, which led to the argument and then the physical contact?
The record is actually unclear as to whether or not the discipline occurred as to one or both of
so
those.
The latter you could attribute to the visitation as occurring, the cause occurring during the visitation itself.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. Even if this court were to read State versus Stoker narrowly so that it did only apply in this instance if something occurred during that visitation, I have kids, and for all of us that do, I mean, we have the right to discipline our kids even when they refuse to speak to us about a particular incident. We may not do so with corporal punishment, but we have that right to do so. The third finding of fact made by the family court was that to the extent that the discipline occurred late at night on a school night, that the acts were not proper parental discipline. That finding is incorrect both because it failed to articulate the standards to protect the constitutional right, the statutory right, but also because it would lead to an absurd result where, for example, a parent would have a right to discipline a child before a certain time at night, 9, 10, or 11, but not after that same time at night. And this court cannot read the statute to lead to such an absurd result. This case is about the real world of parenting and letting parents know how to tailor their behavior to keep themselves out of family court.
So what standard are you suggesting?
We're suggesting that this court provide guidance that standards, for example, akin to those applied in the criminal statute, also be applied in this situation. And actually, as Justice Acoba, if you recognized in the case Resents versus Resents when you were on the ICA, in a situation where the family court was determining whether or not an act was parental discipline under the family violence definition of the child custody provisions of the family code, that the family court was correctly guided by the criminal statute in making that determination. That those provisions must be read to coexist among one another, and that because the two provisions do coexist, physical discipline of a child that is expressly permitted under the criminal statute must also be allowed under the civil family law statute. In that case, it was the child custody, and this is a very similar situation.
So if you apply are guided by the criminal standards, wasn't this abuse because the daughter was apparently struck by the petitioner?
It wasn't abuse, no.
Why wasn't it?
Because we have a right to strike our kids, and we may not choose to do so, and we may not agree with it, but we do have that right. And in this case, not only was that right protected and that there wasn't a clear reason why, for example, under the criminal statute you would take into account the age and size of the child, that it was for the purposes of parental discipline. None of those facts were found in this case.
If we do adopt the criminal defense, who would you say would have the burden establishing?
It would be, I would say, the parent that is asking for that those factors to be considered by the family court.
Comparable to the state in the criminal case.
Correct.
The state's burden to disprove parental discipline beyond reason.
I believe that's correct. Yes.
If I might interrupt, Ms. Copeland, it seems to me after hearing this morning, and that it seemed you mentioned the phrase of real world several times, and it seems to me that the real world is when there's a divorce involved, that the parents frequently have different views as to what the acceptable level of conduct might be, whether it's in the field of morals or school performance or whatever, and that's so on the one hand, One parent could be praising the child for the type of conduct that could be disciplined under your point of view. And doesn't that leave the child in a precarious point of view?
I think that certainly in that circumstance, we would also hope that parents would be amenable to working those issues out with one another, and that's not what always occurs. But that doesn't mean that the parent who doesn't have legal custody doesn't still maintain that fundamental right to discipline their child over in the broad realm of care, custody, and control, and still have the ability to make those decisions and discipline on their own. I think we would all hope that they would work it out together so that there wasn't confusion on the child.
Let me ask you this, though. However, in the restraining order context, the family courts do have the right, and sometimes do, for at least temporarily, require supervised visitation only, sometimes through agencies. Are you saying that the family court would not have the authority to prohibit any corporal discipline during those supervised visits when it is domestic violence that leads to the requirement of supervised visits?
Not at all, and that's not what happened in this case. Mr. Latham did have unsupervised visitation. However, even in this situation, the facts found by the family court weren't even egregious enough to reach the definition of domestic abuse under the statute itself, under Chapter 586. And that's the fundamental problem from a fact-finding perspective solely related to the statute in this case. And then on top of that, you have Mr. Latham's continuing fundamental right to discipline, which was also infringed. The statute was applied unconstitutionally on its face because he retained that right in this case.
Are you arguing that we should hold that subsection 1 of domestic abuse cannot apply to parents versus children? Because domestic abuse does include the threat of imminent physical harm. In other words, it could include a parent saying, if you don't listen to me, I'm going to spank you.
I'm not arguing that at all. In this case, there wasn't a finding of a threat of imminent physical harm. There was a threat of physical harm, and that is still within the realm of protected parental discipline, even under this statute. I think specifically what we're arguing is that at the evidentiary hearing standpoint, that there needs to be further guidance to the courts on how they can find facts so that they aren't infringing on that fundamental right to discipline, which also did not occur in this case. Because the lower courts failed to articulate facts that would take Mr. Latham's...
Well, you mentioned age and size, but we know age, we don't know size. What other factors would you say have to be looked at in terms of the facts of this case to determine whether the court was correct or there was evidence of abuse or not abuse?
Well, under the criminal statute, one of the additional factors that must be considered is whether or not the force was used, in addition to the age and size, was whether or not it was reasonably related to safeguarding or promoting the welfare of the minor, which this court held in State versus Molotave actually includes, for example, although there's no bright line rules that dictate whether corporal punishment is considered reasonable under the statute, the permissible degree of force will vary according to the child's physique and age, the misconduct of the child, the nature of the discipline, and all the surrounding circumstances. And those are the types of factors that in this analogous civil context should be considered by the family court in determining whether or not the protected discipline instead
warrants. Well, applying those factors to your client's case, how would you apply them?
I would apply them so that the family court erred in its finding because there wasn't sufficient,
relating to the facts, how would you
apply them? Right. Mr. Latham's daughter did admit that she had done something wrong, and in fact she also testified that Mr. Latham has the responsibility to discipline her. She testified that there was no bruising so she wasn't physically harmed. She testified that he hit her, but she shielded her so that he only hit her arms, which again...
Excuse me, when you said that she did something wrong, she did admit that she lied to him, you know, in saying that the mother was going to pick her up and she went with her friends. Mm-hmm. But you've indicated that she was disciplined for assisting the friend. So I don't recall from the transcript that she admitted that that was wrong. Why? So that's this court's question. Was she disciplined for lying? Was she disciplined for, you know, refusing to speak to him? Or was she disciplined for assisting the friend? And she did not admit that that was wrong, unless this, there's somewhere in the transcript that maybe the court missed in reviewing it.
No, and I think that, as I mentioned before, the findings certainly aren't clear as to where that line was drawn, and the record isn't clear as to exactly whether or not he disciplined her for one or the other. I think it can be construed to be either scenario, and he retained that right to discipline even under either of those scenarios. And
so under your position, if one parent says it is okay to do an act, they find it morally correct, ethically correct, and then when they go to the other parent's house, and even though it does not occur at their house, they can be disciplined for what was conduct was given approval in the other house.
If that parent retains the residual right to discipline and the fundamental constitutional right to discipline. I see that
I have a question, okay. Ms. Copeland. Ms. Copeland, before the court, the trial court can apply the defense of 703309, there has to be evidence to compel the consideration of the defense. And you went through the some of the requirements of the statute, which were, regard to the age and size, purpose of safeguarding and promoting the welfare. What was the evidence on the record that the father disciplined the child for the purpose of promoting the welfare or for safeguarding her?
He testified that he was that the actions occurred because he was disciplining her. I don't think the testimony used those exact words, but he testified that he was disciplining her for the incident that had occurred related to the morning after pill. But the problem in this case isn't just whether or not the facts as they were presented to the court would lead to, you would be able to apply that defense in this case. It's that there's that gap, and there at the time that the family court made its findings, and there wasn't guidance to the court that the court could consider those types of factors. And that's what we're asking the court to provide today. Okay. If the court has no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Copeland. Mr. Hielke.
May it please the court, on behalf of Lily Hamilton, the respondent, I think the court has to take a look at the issues in reverse. Petitioner has argued that you first look at what are the guidelines, and then secondly, what residual rights does the petitioner have. In this particular case, the parties understood that discipline was something that was part of legal custody. I would turn the court's attention to the Exhibit B on their motion, which was the stipulated order filed in the UCCJ case on September 22, 1999. And it was clear the parties were already divorced years earlier in Missouri, and the court, the trial court in Hawaii, indicated that it was going to have an amendment to joint legal custody, which would include on page 2 of that Exhibit B the manner in which the children shall be disciplined. So in this particular case, the parties knew that part of legal custody was disciplining the children. Fast forward to July 22, 2003, in the same UCCJ case here in Hawaii, the Honorable Darrell Choi, who also heard the FCDA case, the domestic abuse case, issued his oral ruling, and it was filed on August 27, 2003, where he found that because the parties couldn't cooperate, that the defendant, or in this case, the respondent, would have sole legal custody. Now, if you put the two together, it is then clear that the parties understood that the respondent had the sole right to discipline the children. Now, counsel does mention these residual rights, and my client's rights are not totally, you know, clear of the petitioner. If you take a look in Exhibit A.
Mr. Hioki, however, the agreement was, even in the Missouri stipulated order, was the manner in which the children would be disciplined, right? That's what was included within joint legal.
I believe so.
Right, and so was there any evidence as to whether or not there was a disagreement between the parents as to whether or not corporal punishment was a manner of discipline that could be used for these children or forever?
It wasn't set forth specifically in the trial, but the fact that on behalf of the daughter, Ms. Hamilton filed the TRO would indicate that she disapproved of the manner in which her ex-husband had disciplined, if you could call it that, their daughter. And what's interesting is that as part of residual rights that the petitioner retained in page 4 of Exhibit A, which is the order that now gave virtually all custody rights to the respondent, was that she had to consult with him on all legal custody decisions involving the children in advance, with the exception of emergency situations. I think it's clear that there was no emergency situation here, and yet he doesn't consult with her, at least not in the record, as to what to do with Amber for doing the things that she did. And I think that's where the crux of this case is really isolated to these two people, that they don't get along and that they don't respect each other's rights. And obviously it was beginning to affect the children to the point where there's a domestic abuse restraining order being issued by the court.
If I might interrupt you, Mr. Hioki, let me ask you the same question I asked Ms. Copeland. What role, if any, did this TRO play in the underlying custody dispute between the parties?
It's my recollection, since in the UCCJ case I represented Ms. Hamilton, that, you know, we really, it didn't seem to play that much of a role, because child was already 15 and she could have a say as to what she wanted to do. And my recollection is that, you know, in the settlement conference statement, I do wave it around as something that I would be using in trial.
So was it filed to gain some tactical advantage?
Typically, yes, it does lead to that, and to the point where the statutes regarding the use of restraining orders, if they're found to be done frivolously or maliciously, can be then used against the person that filed it. So I would say that can be a problem. But in this particular case, custody had already been decided. The legal custody had already been decided 2 years earlier by the order of Judge Choi in the UCCJ case, and the issue of physical custody had already been decided back in Missouri. So my client retained custody, both physical and legal, by the time that other case was going forward, and it was petitioner seeking to change that for children that would have had a say as to what they wanted to do. So if you take a look at this particular case, it's clear that really the petitioner doesn't have the residual rights to make the claims that he did. And if you look at Judge Choi's ruling, that was what he initially was looking at, was that, and asked Stephen Kim, counsel for the petitioner at the trial, who has legal custody? Well, mom does. How about physical custody? Mom does. And that's exactly what was in his findings of fact, and again, became part of his ruling. The issue of whether or not the statutory provisions of 709-9 should apply is something that counsel appropriately mentioned, and it was considered in the 703-309, and it was something that was considered by the Intermediate Court of Appeals in Resents. But even if you apply that standard here, I think the court would have to look at first who had the right to discipline. The record is also not clear, as was pointed out by the court, as to exactly what was the discipline, exactly what was it that the petitioner was trying to correct for his daughter. And under the circumstances, he had absolutely no right to do what he did. And that's why we believe that, one, Judge Choi was correct, and two, with the way that the petitioner couched his issues, the Intermediate Court of Appeals was just going down the line of, okay, you're raising this issue as to whether or not it's vague and ambiguous or overly broad, you're raising this other issue, and then the last issue that addressed was whether or not the trial court abused its discretion. It didn't really go into the area of, okay, what exactly is the application of parental discipline in this particular case?
Because the ICA rejected the application of 703-309 to this case, right? It said it doesn't apply the domestic abuse TRO statutes broader.
Well, it's definitely Judge Choi did. That was part of his conclusions.
The ICA did too. But I was going to ask you about the abuse, because as I read the transcript, the daughter went out with her friends to get this pill. The father didn't agree with it. He wanted to talk to her about it. She came over and said she had homework and stuff. So he waited 5 hours, according to his testimony, until she could talk with him. At that point, she said it was too late. She wanted to go to bed. And that's when he struck her. And he says that she didn't want to speak to him. She tried to stand up. And so that's when he hit her on the shoulder to make her sit down. So would that fall in within the parameters of abuse?
Under the facts of this particular case, yes, because he didn't have that right to discipline the child based on prior rulings within his...
Well, you're talking about legal right.
Yes.
Assuming that he had a legal right.
Okay.
Would this be fall under parental discipline?
Well, as a father, I would say for a child that old, no, it's not. I mean, if by age 15 you have to use physical force on your child, then as a parent, you fail. I mean, why in the world would you have to go and strike a child that old?
He said she's ranting and raving, doesn't want to talk to him.
Fine. A child, teenagers rant and rave. But
weren't the police called on this occasion?
Yes, the police were called according to the testimony, and if my recollection is correct, I wasn't representing anyone in the FCDA case. No arrests were made. The police checked on on Amber. There's no complaint.
You know what she told the police about how she was, physically or otherwise?
The thought of she was just generally okay comes to mind.
She said she was fine, according to the transcript.
Is there anything in the record to indicate who called the police?
I don't remember. I do know that she asked her sister to call mom, and then as to what happened after that, I'm not clear on that. In terms of, though, you know, going back to whether or not this is discipline, I think that, one, if we are going to do guidelines as the ICA has done in Resents, you have to take a look at 703-309, but sort of temper it with another provision within that statute, which is 703-301, subsection 2, and where it indicates the fact that conduct is justified under this chapter does not abolish or impair any remedy for such conduct which is available in any civil action. So if the court is to consider...
I'm sorry, would you repeat that?
Sure. It's under 703-301, subsection 2. It says, the fact that conduct is justifiable under this chapter does not abolish or impair any remedy for such conduct which is available in any civil action. My reading of this is basically saying, you know, it looks like the defenses in 703-302 through 703-309 don't necessarily apply, or it even can say shall not abolish, impair, or impair any remedy in the civil case for the same conduct. In the comments, it goes.
It just leaves a variety of options available.
Yes, it does. And I was wrestling with this in my mind and thinking, well, this court could say we're going to adopt something along these lines and then tailor it for the family situation. But just as you have in this case, a very unique situation on legal custody, you know, it has to be, you know, broad enough so that it covers many cases, and yet not so broad that it then becomes unconstitutionally, you know, impermissible. What the solution is, that I have no idea. You know, I do know that, you know, if we're looking at saying that a parent that really didn't have the right to discipline can do it under these residual rights, then what else is left? Let's say you have a mom that says, okay, you know, I belong to a particular religion and I don't want any flu vaccinations. And then dad, out of, you know, after a messy divorce, possibly out of spite or a differing opinion, and he doesn't have legal custody, takes the child down for a free flu vaccination. How does that help the family situation when we gave legal custody to one parent and the other one sort of thumbs its nose at it? This is especially true with the ICA case in Bencomo versus Bencomo, where the Interim Court of Appeals specifically noted that if one parent has sole legal custody, the court cannot start to interfere and say, all right, you will take the child to this type of activity, or moreover, you know, this is how discipline shall be done. Once there is legal custody to one parent, then I think the court must necessarily observe that and really respect that parent's decision.
But the statute itself is neutral. It applies to persons having legal custody and having visitation rights.
309,
but the domestic.
Oh, yes, that's correct. And you know, that is something of a problem in terms of, okay, as I believe Justice McKenna had asked the question, okay, where do we draw the line?
So we still would need to draw the line, assuming you could bring in someone who had legal custody under the statute.
Correct. For those other cases, that's correct.
But in any event, what is the sanction for violating a protection order?
Jail, okay. Fines.
So there is a criminal, it's a misdemeanor, so there's a criminal sanction attached to a violation of this civil order.
Violating the order for protection or even the TRO, that's correct. Yes, most definitely. In terms of how this particular order for protection affected the petitioner, it seems to be more of an argument. I know that this court had granted certiorari on the issue of mootness and did point out to several things, but really, you know, there's nothing in the record that indicated that any of those dangers applied to him.
I thought, that's the question I asked. I thought I saw in the paper something about, as a result of the TRO issuing, reports had to be made to two government agencies.
You know, that's something that I have no idea about, and I'm not sure what the governmental agencies would be. You know, I just don't know. I know that one of the most common complaint for defendants in a TRO case is if they're hunters and they have guns, or if their job requires them to carry firearms and then it becomes something of a problem, what do we do there? That's number one. The number two complaint is many times it's used in divorce cases, paternity cases, as leverage, where you can show that the defendant violated or has a TRO against them, and therefore it is used quite effectively by the trial courts. But in terms of any other penalty that the petitioner suffered, I just couldn't see it. I could understand the mootness issue being addressed for maybe future cases. But as I stated in my own application for certiorari, where the Intermediate Court of Appeals was going to dismiss the underlying case, I indicated that, you know, he could have filed a stay of the Judge Choi's order, and then we would be resolving this here. I mean, now the child has already graduated from college. It's been, you know, many years that have gone by, and you know, for this court, it does give the opportunity for some sort of guidelines in this particular in this general type of case. But in this particular case, I think the Intermediate Court of Appeals has to be upheld because of the way that the legal custody issues were resolved and not appealed from by either party.
But his claim, and which this court previously decided, was that he had an interest in his reputation, and that's why the mootness question was set aside. So would have at least that effect in terms of, it would have some impact on his reputation.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Your Honor. That's correct.
And so are the other child obligations under the divorce decree still in effect?
Well, both children, I believe, are adults now. They're both attending college. And so the only obligations remaining would be petitioner's contribution towards the higher education expenses. But custody and child support, I'll represent to you, my client has reported he's not paid child support. It's not assisted. She has these two up in the mainland, works in a middle income job, has her daughter from another, her current husband, who's on disability. She's doing everything by herself. And you really don't, from just these two orders, don't get the flavor of what it was like between, especially for my client, to deal with this. And if you saw the transcript, I think, and also if you, I don't know if you read the opening brief on how he characterized my client. It's interesting to hear about his rights, yet he's totally disregarded her rights as a sole legal custodian. To what extent that becomes relevant, I don't know, but I, on behalf of her, I just want to let you know that. I know I have more time, but I kind of run out of things to tell the court. Is there anything else? Any other questions?
We appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hilke. Ms. Copeland, how much time does she have left? All right.
May it please the court. I'd just like to take my last 2 minutes to respond to a couple of the points made by opposing counsel. First, the lower courts, both the ICA and the family court, they did not address the application or something akin to the criminal statute in this situation. What those courts held is that a criminal statute cannot be applied in the civil context, and therefore they did not consider the types of factors that appear in that statute.
What do you make of 703.301, subsection 2?
All that that provision goes to a similar argument, that being that you wouldn't apply the criminal statute in a civil context. But that's not what we're asking. What we're asking is this: that this court provide guidance that those same type of
parents. What if in this case, or in any case, if there are parents that disagree as to matters of discipline. Some parents do not believe in corporal punishment. What if that parent is given legal and physical custody? Are you saying that the residual parental rights include the other parent can still employ corporal punishment even if the parent given legal custody does not believe in that type of discipline?
Under 571.2 and State versus Stoker, in those circumstances, yes, that parent would retain the residual parental right to discipline. And that
but
right
that
to
was a criminal case, correct?
That's correct.
And we were dealing with the parental justification in a criminal case.
That's correct. And what we're asking is that this court apply those similar factors in this civil context. Thank you very much.
The court will take this matter under advisement.